Thank you, Claire. I've been told I must speak slowly for the audience out there. Thank you for the invitation to be part of this conversation. I'm privileged to share the podium with two very distinguished leaders whom I deeply admire. It's always a hard act to follow a woman, isn't it? I hope that what I can offer tonight is something which is coherent with their contributions. YTU is, of course, my alma mater, where I was trained for the priesthood in the 80s. Then it was not exactly known as a bastion of orthodoxy. Therefore, it is obvious to many that someone didn't do his homework properly for Pope Benedict before he appointed me a bishop. Well, folks, the Catholic Church in this country is at a crossroads, and that's putting it very mildly. In colloquial language, we might say that we're up the proverbial creek without a paddle. The Royal Commission has exposed a moral disease that has spread right through the body that is the Church. And Pope Francis often speaks of the cancer of clericalism, and the two are closely linked, and I believe we cannot tackle the sexual abuse crisis effectively without confronting the clerical culture, which is guilty of aiding and abetting it. I'm of the view that we are in a unique situation because of the Royal Commission. No other country in the world has conducted a similar national inquiry, which is as comprehensive in its scope as ours. So we ought to be thankful. It has brought about a heightened level of public consciousness, not only of the sexual abuse crisis, but also of the Church's appalling failures. Francis Sullivan has rightly observed that child sexual abuse has broken the heart of the Church in Australia. So there is an urgency on our part, on the part of those who love the Church as a faith community, to mend that broken heart and to restore confidence to it. Because we owe it to the victims, to the people of God, to the gospel of Christ, in addressing the biggest challenge of our time, and in building a healthier Church for generations to come. One of the ways to which we can build a healthier Church is to rid it of clericalism, to make it less of a Church of the ordained and more of the Church of the baptized. The latter facilitates a more collaborative, empowering and dynamic pilgrim community, whereas the former favors a more clerical, male-dominated and top-down model. A few months ago, I visited a seminary called Mundelein Seminary in Chicago. And in the chapel of that seminary, I noticed an interesting feature. There were seven steps leading to the high altar, and on the side of each step was written the respective name of one of the seven holy orders, you know, from porter to exorcist and lector and so on to priesthood. Each step would create an ever-growing chasm, and that's just a physical chasm, but a power distance between the candidate and the people. It dawned on me that these vestiges of the Tridentine model priesthood are powerful symbols of the clerical class. It is part of the ecclesiology that emphasizes the ontological change and separation of the ordained from the non-ordained. It is a powerful ingredient and the ideal condition for the disease of clericalism to fester. And I believe we need to dismantle this clerical triumphalist elitist church model, variously described as a pyramid or perfect society or the monarchical model. For I hold that this model, which promotes the superiority of the ordained and the excessive emphasis on the role of the clergy at the expense of the unordained, the unwashed like you, is at the very root of the culture of clericalism that we inherited. The crisis we face is linked very strongly with the crisis of a particular paradigm of being church. Now, I'm not suggesting that this old way of being church has been all but bad, negative, but I'm arguing that this model is inadequate and even irrelevant insofar as it is deeply embedded in clericalist, patriarchal, and monarchical mindset. It is incapable of helping us to meet the challenges of modernity. We're on this side now of Charles Darwin. We're on this side now of the civil rights movement. We're on this side now of the sexual revolution. So I don't believe that we need to be held captive, ransomed to that absolute model of church. The difficulty which we are facing today is that we're living in a transition period between the dying model of church and an emerging model of church. Much of the clerical culture of our church reflects the now dying model of church. Besides the tendency on the part of the hierarchy to revert to the default position, and that's why I think when there is a shortage of priests, we bring them from overseas. And that's the default position that we are working on. There is also a small but vocal movement which seeks to resist change and to re-establish the old order. There needs to be a bold and strong leadership to nurture and to enable the emerging model to prevail. There is also a need for committed people who act like critical yeast in critical time. There is the Australian Democrats used to have a very catchy slogan, "Keep the bastards honest." You remember that? The church needs prophetic voices, even voices from the margins and from the outside, from outside the system, to keep its leaders honest and transparent and accountable. We cannot afford to let the momentum for cultural and structural change in the church to fizzle out. Can't afford to do that. It is for the sake of a healthier church that all the baptized participate in its functioning and bring their gifts to bear on its life. How do I encourage the participation of the people in the life of my diocese? It boils down to how I promote a less of a clerical top-down model of church and more a collaborative, participatory, and consultative kind of model. One of my priorities is to capture the energy of the people at the base by way of encouraging the practice of consultation and collaboration and collective discernment at various levels. As we journey towards the National Plenary 2020, we set up channels of listening in my diocese and discerning together as church. Another more personal way is to embody the post-clericalist mindset in my style of living, relating, and engaging with others. I try to emulate Pope Francis by living like ordinary people in simplicity and poverty. I'm proud to be a regular customer of Tiger Airways, for instance. And you know what? I blend in perfectly with the Bogans on board. A few times I shocked my staff at the gentry by appearing in shorts, t-shirt, and runners. And it's a deliberate strategy on my part because I believe that I have to be seen as a human person first and foremost. Not all the time with this Roman collar and, you know, the trappings of the office. So every now and again, I run around up and down the corridor in various parts of the building and just say hi in my t-shirt and runners. I think the Episcopal mystique is truly well and gone. As we move to a more pilgrim community model, it is also necessary to foster a culture of encounter and dialogue. And that's my second point. Pope Francis speaks of an inverted pyramid, which is a radical way of exercising power and authority, or the term that Maria prefers, influence. It is not a top-down and centralized approach reminiscent of the monarchical model. Rather, it is a synodal church at every level, with everyone listening to each other, learning from each other, and taking responsibility for proclaiming the gospel. Vatican II already spoke of the key principles of collegiality, subsidiarity, and sensus fidelium, all of which pointed to a more listening, dialogical, and inclusive church. Pope Francis himself has lived up to this vision of church, daring to break loose from its comfort zone and self-referential mentality. He has challenged us to be a compassionate, merciful, open, and inclusive church. He has privileged a style of leadership which involves more deep, respectful listening and collective discernment. The Synod on the Family gave us that window into his vision of a synodal church. It was marked by disruption, chaos, and drama, but also by a deep sense of dialogue for the common good, or parousia, you know, that frankness, that boldness with which one speaks truth to power. Parousia. In the end, what was invigorating about the Synod was not only the documents that it produced. It was not only Amoris Laetitia, which is causing all sorts of controversy to some segments of the church. But the journey of synodality that energized the church, as far as I'm concerned, it is the unleashing of the energy long locked up beneath the eyes of institutional security that truly matters. The energy had been trapped in a rigid control and was released by boldness, freedom, and frankness, but parousia. A synodal spirit must be at work at the diocesan level as well as the universal church. In my diocese, one of my priorities is to promote this synodal spirit through various listening and dialogical vehicles such as parish pastoral councils, deanery councils, and diocesan pastoral council. These and other consultative bodies are meant to connect the diocese to the grassroots and to help me to discern and respond to the new needs and concerns of the people. I also believe that we need to listen to the voices at the margins and voices of those who disagree with us. Transformation within the church will not be facilitated by divisiveness and polarizing disposition. Grace will not flow freely through the barriers of our fear, intransigence, and mutual exclusion. Cardinal Maria Martini wisely observed that we must learn to quarrel, but to quarrel peacefully, in the spirit of open and honest dialogue. While there is no instant reconciliation or perfect convergence, we must not divert from the task of listening, conversing, and understanding one another in that spirit of mutual trust. One of the tasks I did before writing my letter on same-sex marriage was to seek out and to listen to the LGBTI community. I met both LGBTI individuals and their parents, a number of them anyway, and the parents are known as PFLAG, parents and friends of lesbian and gays. It was a steep learning curve for me as I was challenged out of my secure, privileged world of being male, heterosexual, and of course, the ultimate privilege of being an ordained person. I felt I could not write about them or about an issue that concerns them without a deep and respectful dialogue with them and their families. And I'm glad I did it. And I'm convinced that we cannot be a credible community of disciples if the voices from elsewhere, and not often the prophets were. They were from outside the dominant system. And they spoke a different narrative from the dominant narrative. They provided a subversion, you know, the subversion that is subversive. So we need to hear these voices from elsewhere and hear them respectfully. Thirdly, I believe a healthier church is not possible until its leaders have reclaimed the core gospel values of powerlessness, vulnerability, and servant leadership. These are not just private virtues, but the antidotes to the disease of clericalism. Much of what is unhealthy with the church today stems from the travesty of Christian leadership and service. As far as I'm concerned, the sexual abuse crisis is only the tip of the iceberg. Bishop Jeff Robinson observes that we can no longer limit our blame to individuals who offended, you know, the bad apples. We must also look for factors within this very culture of the church that have contributed, that have aided the sexual abuse crisis. In the aftermath of the Las Vegas massacre, people talked a lot about the lexicon control law in America, as they have done sadly too frequently. Any people from the U.S. sitting in the audience? Oh, there's two. I contend that we cannot deal with one or even several particular issues in society without addressing the cultural assumptions that give rise to them in the first place. In the case of the American society that is beset by gun-fueled violence, one wonders if the notion of American hegemony and exceptionalism, with its emphasis on dominance and power, needs to be challenged. For this foundational assumption underneath the American exceptionalism and hegemony is linked, I believe, as a corollary, if not the root cause, of America's obsession with weaponry and violence, individually and also collectively. So I believe that we have to approach the sexual abuse crisis in the church analogously. We need to explore the deeper issues that lie underneath the phenomenon. Unless we have the courage to see how far we've drifted from the vision of Jesus, that humble, powerless servant, unless we are prepared to go beyond the symptoms and explore the deeper cultural and structural issues that lie, that lurk behind the surface, unless we genuinely repent of institutional failures, we will not be able to restore confidence and trust in the church. By the way, there was that delegation of bishops and members of the Truth, Justice and Healing Council going to Rome to talk to the officials there about ways to restore trust, restore confidence. But I believe that the work has to be done here and has to be done by the very people here. The church can only be a conduit of compassion and speak. No, sorry. When privilege, power, and dominance are more evident than love, humility, and servanthood in the church, then the very gospel of the servant Christ is at risk. But what we need to reclaim forcefully and unequivocally is the notion of powerlessness, vulnerability, and servant leadership. And to this end, we as leaders need to manifest that in who we are and what we do. And until we have reclaimed powerlessness, vulnerability, and servant leadership, the church will be less than what Christ intends it to be. The church can only be the conduit of compassion and speak the language of hope to a broken humanity when it truly personifies powerlessness and stands where Christ once stood, and that is firmly on the side of the outcast. And finally, I believe the old way of being church, in which is deeply steeped in clerical practice and structure, is coming to an end. I'd like to use the metaphor of the wine at the wedding feast in Cana to describe the transition between the dying paradigm and emerging one. Like the old wine, the old ecclesial paradigm rooted in clerical hegemony, likewise, well serve the church we love. But that model of church, like its corollary, the exalted, separated, elitist priesthood, is drawing its last breaths. It is time for us to drink the new wine that is being poured. The new wine of God's unconditional love, of radical inclusivity and equality, needs to be poured into the wineskins of humility, mutuality, compassion, and powerlessness. The old wineskins of triumphalism, authoritarianism, supremacy, abetted by clerical power, superiority, and rigidity, are breaking. When Jesus sent out his disciples to announce the good news, he did so in pairs. What I derive from that practice of his is that Christians can only minister effectively when they recognize their limits as individuals and are open to partnership with others. Yet, ironically, the whole culture of priestly formation is often geared towards individual heroism. The cure of Allah, you know, John Vianney, is probably the patron saint par excellence of the kind of priestly individual heroism. No wonder many of priests suffer from ministerial burnout, depression, and loneliness. If the priesthood has a better future, it has to find expression in better mutual support, collaboration, and partnership. And I would especially emphasize the ability to minister with women, because the church is much the poorer without the gift of women. A Protestant minister was invited to the housewarming party of a Catholic priest. As the host showed him around the magnificent new presbytery, the Protestant minister remarked with a wink of his eye, "You Catholic priests might have better quarters, but we have better halves." Perhaps the joke is on us priests who fail to appreciate the gospel injunction of ministering in mutuality and partnership. It is my belief that male disciples need to learn from female disciples the core gospel values of powerlessness, vulnerability, and servant leadership. Perhaps the privilege of maleness in our patriarchal church and our still male-dominated society makes us blind to the power we enjoy. We male disciples need to be alerted to this blind spot, just as we need colored people to tell white people that race matters, or gay people to tell straight people that gender matters in ways that we don't always appreciate experientially. Though I come from a humble background, I have other privileges, such as being male, heterosexual, and ordained, which incline me to a certain ways of thinking, judging, and acting. I need to learn from the wisdom of otherness. So it seems to me that the church has a way to go yet in terms of appreciating women's gifts and institutionalizing them for the benefits of the community until we have truly incorporated the gift of women and the feminine dimension of the Christian faith. Will not be able to fully energize the life of the church. It was with this conviction that I appointed the first female chancellor and member of the diocesan curia in my diocese in the person of Sister Catherine Ryan, a Mercy sister. And I wanted to send a strong message to my clergy and people that the church at every level will benefit from the unique gifts, insights, perspectives that women bring with them. The church is being reborn in ways beyond the traditional structures. Like the river that has changed its course, we have a choice to make. It is not yearning for and holding on to the known and the familiar, which a lot of people are trying to do. But in reimagining the future and venturing into the unknown chaos, like the old Exodus, that we shall find new life. The Paschal rhythm summons us to a discipleship of humility, vulnerability, and powerlessness, of dying and rising in Christ. I think we must die to the old way of being church, steeped in clerical power, dominance, and privilege. We must abandon the old paradigm of a fortress church, which is prone to exclusivity and elitism. We must learn to rise to a more Christ-like way of humility, inclusivity, compassion, powerlessness. In the end, though, I firmly believe that we are on that threshold of renewal and transformation. Long ago, 50 years ago, the Vatican Council set in motion that new paradigm that I talked about. And this cannot be thwarted by fear and paralysis. The new paradigm, based on mutuality, not exclusion, love, not fear, service, not clericalism, engagement with the world, not hostility against it, not building a fortress against it, incarnate grace, not dualism. And so, may the Holy Spirit accompany us as we move boldly in that direction. Thank you.